Hello, everyone. My name is Kelvin Daniels. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kelvin. Welcome.
So over there, the grace of God, Miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of recovery is laid out in this book, and a great sponsor. I have a drink since October 10th, 1996, and for that, I'm truly grateful. I want to thank Billy for asking me to share tonight. It's an honor and a privilege whenever I'm asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've always wanted to go to your guys' estate. I've never been there before, so whether it's virtually or whatever, I'm able to be there, so that's cool. I wanna thank anyone who does the service of getting these things put together. One of the things that's gotten more difficult is the search of trying to go out and find speakers and set Zoom up and websites and to make all this stuff possible. So I want to thank anybody whose service commitment has been involved in doing that as well. And I was asked to share tonight and share my story with you guys. And it's kind of an interesting deal. I've got people that I know that are on this call. So if I'm not honest, then they'll be able to tell me. And even more, it's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at a big book study earlier today and we were working through the end of working with others and it's that process that we have of reaching a hand out and helping that alcoholic that's struggling next to us, the person who's dying of this illness, and the ability to be able to do that and the ability to be able to carry a message today is I think one of the most prolific things that we get to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't start off in AA. I grew up in Minot, North Dakota, and it's kind of a funny thing. Yes, I'm from North Dakota, but you're not going to hear me say yeah, sure, or you betcha, or any of the other stuff that people that movie Fargo ruined for all of us up here. They seem to think everybody's like that. I've had people ask me if I have a horse. No, I don't have a horse. But that's just kind of the deal. My mom met my dad who was in the military and they got together and I was born. And I was automatically different than everyone else around me because one of the craziest things that ended up happening was my dad never got stationed anywhere else. We had our orders canceled 3 times when I was growing up and they sent him TDY a few times. But other than that, I was born in Minot. I was raised in Minot and that's where we stayed. And it was just a crazy deal. And if you're growing up on the military installation, if you're like anybody else, what you're supposed to do is be there for a couple, 3 years and then get to go somewhere else. And so I was pretty excited for that deal. And the problem is that when you're the odd duck out and you're the kid that's on the airbase that's never got to go to any other airbase or anywhere else, then that's a problem. So what would happen is everybody else is on their normal schedule. So the guys down the street would move out and they had been to a base in Texas or somewhere in Oklahoma or hell, I'd have settled for Nebraska. I mean, it'd have been great. Anything would have been better than North Dakota. And so they would leave. And what would happen is the next group of kids would move into the neighborhood and it's kind of like in jail, you know, like what are you in for? You know, you show up on the airbase, first thing people ask is, where have you guys been? And so I had to start taking their stories. So pretty soon, I've been to about 6 or 7 different bases and I've got a good storyline built up and it's a great deal. And the problem with that is I was out in my front yard one day and I was talking about how hot it was in Texas or something. And all of a sudden I heard my name in a shrill voice at the top of her lungs, yelling my name. And it was my mom. And she yells, Kevin! She comes outside and grabs me by my afro and drags me in the house and physically explains to me why I shouldn't lie. And a couple things happened after that moment. One, I realized that I'm going to have to make sure that stupid kitchen window is closed going forward. And two, I got to figure out how to make this right with these guys because I've got a reputation here. I got to figure out how I'm going to fix the situation. And see, that's the problem. I've suffered from the illness of alcoholism from my earliest memory. See, when I was growing up, I just felt like I didn't quite fit where I was. I couldn't be where my hands were. And it seemed that there was something that was off inside of me, and it seemed to not be able to connect with y'all. But what ended up happening was I didn't know that those things were part of that restless, irritable, and discontentment that they talked about. I didn't know what those things were called. All I knew is I felt like I was odd and I was out and that things didn't matter. And unfortunately, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to learn these things, and I started to learn the terms that we use here, and it started making a lot of sense. And so I figured out that when I was restless, it was the kind of restlessness that I have is if you ever watch a dog lay down, they kind of circle and they drop. And I'm a dog that can't find its spot. I just seem to never be able to be okay where I am. It's always a little bit better over there with them, or a little bit better over there with her, or some other situation going on. But something has got to be better than where I am in the moment. And I have the kind of irritability that I just know I'm getting screwed by everybody all the time. That no matter what, that it's all you against me. And I have that kind of irritability that when people say something, I seem to just take it personally. I don't know why, it just happens. And then I have that other kind of irritability that if you do something wrong to me, you cut me off in traffic, I got to start planning the perfect pit maneuver where I can just clip your bumper just right so that you'll turn sideways and that semi oncoming will tear you in half, because that way the world has one less a-hole and we don't have to worry about you anymore. And I have the kind of discontentment that even when I seem to get the things I want, it's not enough. And that's, it's like I said, like a dog, circle, drop. There we go. That's what it is. I figured you guys needed a sound effect. She was supposed to kick that off during that part, but she missed her cue. but I have the kind of discontentment that even if I get the things I want, they're not enough. Even if something happens that seems like it's going to fix the problem in the moment, it's just not enough. The next job isn't enough. The money isn't enough. The vehicle isn't enough. And, you know, I wanted this certain truck and I ended up getting this truck, and it was a really awesome deal. And I thought I was the only guy with one like it. And, you know, 25 minutes later, I'm stopping at a red light and here comes a guy pulling up next to me with the same damn truck, you know, and I just can't take that kind of stuff. It just makes me crazy. And that's the problem is that when I spend my life in a constant wanting and lack of power in my life, that I have to depend on everything else around me in order to make me whole and complete me inside. And I didn't realize that this restlessness, irritability, and discontentment was going to be the thing that would stick with me as I was growing up. But that's what happened. And I grew up in a tough way, and I've heard a lot of people say a lot of different things, and psychologists and psychiatrists and all these other things that people say. But that just because of the way I grew up, it doesn't make me an alcoholic. It doesn't make me have alcoholism. See, what happens with me is that I'm not somebody who blames what my upbringing was for my actions. See, there was something inside of me that had nothing to do with what my upbringing was. So I was in seventh grade and I'm in a gym class, and in this gym class we were playing wiffle ball inside. And it gets really cold up here in North Dakota. I know we were in the national news here about a month and a half ago because we had like 16 or 18 days in a row that were below zero. And the lowest was like 60 below zero with a wind chill, which is just cold. I mean, it's bitter. And so we're inside playing wiffle ball in the gym. And I, of course, being up in North Dakota, you have to kind of root for the Twins a little bit. And Kirby Puckett was big during that time. And everybody wanted to try to do that. So I'm swinging for the fences and I struck out playing wiffle ball. And that's kind of embarrassing. And what made it worse is that the gym teacher decided he was going to laugh at me too. And pretty soon he's laughing. So everybody else is laughing because I struck out playing wiffle ball. I don't know how you handle public humiliation, but I handle it in a specific way. So I started beating the teacher with the bat. And, which I used to just leave the story there because it sounds gangster, right? It sounds just hard. Like, oh, don't mess with him. He'll beat you with a bat. It was a plastic bat. Which made it worse with his reactions because, see, when you're getting hit with a bat, you don't realize until you realize the bones aren't breaking and it's just giving you welts that you're getting hit with a plastic bat. So he's screaming bloody murder like he's getting beat to death with a Louisville slugger. And and it was a plastic wiffle ball bat. But when they call the psychiatrist and the psychologist and all the people with all the initials after their name, they don't seem to make a determination between a Louisville Slugger and a plastic bat. To them, it's all the same bucket. So I have to go start seeing a lot of people that have a lot of initials after their name, and I have to go in to see this counselor, and this counselor's sitting in front of me, and he's going to hardline me. So he looks at me and he says, hey kid, why don't you cut the crap and tell me what's really going on? And at this time, I'm not the menacing size that I am today. You know, I'm 5'4 and a buck 20, you know, and most of that 5'4 was afro. So, I mean, I wasn't a big dude. And this guy's hardlining me across the desk, and he's got this little crystal figurine that's got a little guy that looks like a golf player inside of it getting ready to swing a club. And I look at the guy and I say, you know, I feel like grabbing your paperweight there and beating you with it until you quit shaking and moving. And he looked at me and he said, session's over. And he threw me out of his office. And I got to go back in the next day to see the same guy, and the paperweight was gone. And I realized that what I would have to do in my life is I'd have to try to keep people at a distance away from me so I didn't have to deal with what was really going on inside of me. But see, if I had to answer that guy that day, I didn't have the terminology of restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't have the terminology of being hypersensitive. I didn't have the terminology of this lack of power that's inside of me. I didn't have any of those things to say. All I could say is, I don't know. I don't know. And see, when you say you don't know to those kind of people, then they turn around and they say that's not an acceptable answer. And they keep digging. And eventually you got to give them something. So I kept people at a distance like that. And around that same time, I got a chance to drink. And see, what drinking does for me, drinking was the very first spiritual experience I ever had in my life. It was the very first thing that ever turned something on inside of me that I desperately needed turned on inside of me. It stripped away all the things that I had going on in my life, and it made me whole and it made me complete, and it gave me the ability to look you in the eye and not be ashamed of what I was. And I didn't know that that's what it was going to do. All I knew was when I got with my boys, Jimmy and Johnny, and we drank for that first time, that it was magical and it was spiritual. And then I would end up chasing that into the point of death. And I didn't realize that was going to be my path, but that was that first day. And I chased that, as it so eloquently says in the book. So I ended up struggling going through the rest of school, and I'd get out of school and I had a very keen mind and a phenomenal athletic ability. So I had scholarship offers across the nation for football and wrestling. I had a congressional nomination at the Air Force Academy to play football and wrestle there, Division I. And I don't know how you guys handle things when people are starting to give them to you. But see, the problem is that nobody told me that you take this next drink and that's going to be the thing that wipes your future away. Nobody said to me, hey, man, you take this next drink and that's going to be the time that you have to give away that next little piece of your soul that you thought wasn't going to have to leave. And the problem is that I didn't have a warning label on any of the drinks that I had in front of me. So I would just have to jump on, and I would have to struggle through, and I'd have to burn my life to the ground. And I didn't know that I was going to end up being that guy, because I'm the guy that everybody's given all the potential talks to, and everybody that's saying, man, you can do anything you want. You know, you can be this, you can be that, you have all this potential. And I didn't realize that what the definition of potential was. It's kind of a funny thing. Potential is unused energy, right? So they're telling me that, you know, I have all these things I can really do because I'm really not doing much, you know. But it sounds like a compliment when these people with all the initials after their name are telling you what it is. So I end up walking into Alcoholics Anonymous by the age of 20 years old. By the time I'm 20 years old, I've got 5 felonies hanging over my head. And I've given away every piece and every part of my soul that I think I could possibly give away in the moment. I'm doing things to God's kids and seeing things done to God's kids nobody's ever supposed to see or do. I'm collecting for dealers, and I'm hurting people for money, and I'm doing unspeakable things to people. What I brought you is, I love this part in the book where it says an alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. And that's what I brought you. That's what I brought Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody that was completely unlovable. Somebody that didn't have a direction to go and somebody that just regardless of consequence ended up being the kind of person that I was. And see, the problem was, is that all these people in my life are telling me I have a drinking problem, right? They're telling me this over and over and over again. They're telling me I have a drinking problem. I have a drinking problem. And I don't understand what it is. See, I don't have a drinking problem. It looks like a drinking problem on the outside. See, if I had a drinking problem, if I was somebody who had a drinking problem and not alcoholism, the day that my mother looked at me and told me she was ashamed she gave birth to me and I was no longer her son, that would have been enough for me to quit drinking. The day that I woke up covered in blood that wasn't mine and I couldn't remember where I had been for 3 days. See, that's enough to scare you enough to get you to quit drinking. The day that the people in my life looked at me with those eyes and just closed them and just shook their head because they couldn't do anything else. The day that they told me that I was supposed to go to the state hospital for an undetermined amount of time would have been enough to scare somebody like me if I had a drinking problem. But I don't have a drinking problem. I have alcoholism. I have this thing that happens when I take a drink, a metaphysical reaction happens within my body, and somehow I get thirsty when I drink. I don't seem to have an off switch. And that no matter what the situation is, I can try to moderate. I can try to do all these things that it tells us that it happens, but I can't seem to shut it off when it's time to shut it off. And if that's the case, if I was just an abnormal drinker, if I was somebody who just had a drinking problem, that would be just fine because I would never have to drink again because the consequences would be enough for me to stop. But the thing is, I have this other piece, this other thing that's called the obsession of the mind. It's the ultimate liar. It's the thing that sits on my shoulder and tells me that it's okay. It's the thing that starts saying stuff to me like, man, you're part Irish. When you drink whiskey, you're supposed to fight people. That's part of your heritage, you know? I mean, it's the ultimate justifier. It's the thing that tells me that I need to get mad at the people who designed washing machines because the lid flips up like a toilet. So if I use your washing machine like a toilet, it is not my fault. It is the design of the washing machine. If it was a front loader and it swung this way, I would have never used it like a toilet. It's not my fault. But see, it's that kind of stuff. It's the thing that tells me you were with those guys doing that stuff. And if you would just quit hanging around with all these fools, you'd quit getting in trouble. So I wouldn't hang with those fools and I'd still get in trouble. It's the thing that tells me that it's going to be okay. It's the thing that tells me that, man, it's fine. You can go ahead. You're 20 years old. You're supposed to. So I have a mind that lies to me and a body that wants to destroy me. So I go through and I take the next drink and it kicks off the whole thing again. And I can't seem to stay stopped and I can't figure out why. And so people start calling me things like crazy. And people start saying things to me that you don't want to hear. And then that was just wonderful. People started telling me I need to go to church. I loved that. That was my favorite one. You know, hey, you need to go back to church. And I don't know how you guys grew up, but I grew up in a very strict religious home. And I don't know if you guys have this denomination down here, but it was real popular in my household. It was called Norwegian Lutheran Southern Baptist. It's a wonderful religion. It means that when you go to church with your mom, that it's strict Norwegian Lutheran, and when you go to church with your dad, that it's Southern Baptist, and that so you get pulled in both directions. So I'd go to my mom's church, and it was just wonderful, you know. They apparently didn't read that part in the Bible where it said make a joyful noise. They skipped that piece because there was nothing joyful about any of the singing in that church. Everything was monotone, you know. It was praise God to whom all blessings flow. I mean, I don't think that anybody ever even broke an octave in that place. It was crazy. And when you're a kid that's restless, irritable, and discontent, that restless piece of it, that's the problem, is that, you know, I'm just this kid and I'm moving around and I'm in the hymnal, I'm out of the hymnal, and I'm in the hymnal, I'm out of the hymnal, and I'm just a nightmare. And my mom is sitting there next to me and she gives me that karate chop to the throat, you know, mess it off. You know, you do the quick little jab thing that you get so nobody sees you hit your kid. And so she'd give me one of that and give me that heavy pinch behind the arm that just hurts like hell, you know, like, ah, you know, you think somebody just probably stabbed you, but it's just a pinch, you know, I'd get one of those. And that's all I know about church, you know. And then the next week we go to my dad's church, and the Southern Baptist church, there was a guitar and drums in that church. And I'm in the thing, and I'm in the hymnal, I'm out of the hymnal, and I'm moving around. And my mom gave me the karate chop, and this big black lady in a great big church hat leans forward, and she says, "Don't you touch that boy. He's just being moved by the Spirit." And I tell you what, that was all I needed. I could act the fool at Baptist church. And if I really made my mom mad and she was really going to throw down on me, I would just have to get up and stand up and just yell hallelujah quick. And pretty soon you do that, everybody else stands up and they start singing a song. And I don't even know what the song is, but everybody's singing one. And I'm not getting beat in the pew. So I think it's a win, you know? So, I mean, that's what I know. And the other thing that I knew about God is the Old Testament. And apparently I skipped the whole New Testament when it came to understanding God. See, my idea of God was all the things that you hear, you know, it's, you don't listen and you want to act the fool and not do what he tells you to do. And you go out in the water, he sends a big fish to come in and just swallow you. You know, I mean, it's on, you know, you guys are talking about going tuna fishing. Not if you don't listen to God, you're going to get swallowed. You know, I mean, that's just the whole thing. You know, that was just the deal. And that if you think you think that you're big and strong and bad and that you think you're a tough guy, he sends a woman in to destroy you and cut off all your hair. You know, I mean, that's just the whole thing. Right. And that if you start having sex and doing stuff you're not supposed to do, you killer assault. You know, Sodom and Gomorrah, you're going to rain fire on your ass from heaven. You know, I mean, that's what God is. So when you start telling me I got to go to church, that doesn't make sense to me. See, because I know that if everything that I learned as a kid growing up is true, that means he saw what I did to his kids. That means he seen me. That means he saw the blood on my hands. So that whole God thing isn't going to work for someone like me. See, he works for good people. He doesn't work for people like me. So when you start telling me I gotta find a God, then that's just not going to work. That doesn't fly for someone like me. So that's what I brought you in Alcoholics Anonymous. I brought you the kind of guy that was, when growing up, his dad kept telling him over and over again, "Boy, you better fear the Lord." And I didn't realize fear biblically meant respect, right? I didn't know that. I was just scared of God. And see, my dad was the kind of guy that if his Bible looked like my big book, you know, it's highlighted and tabbed and it was ready to rock and roll, you know. And so the Jehovah's Witnesses would roll by our house and he'd let them in and he'd get them all comfortable and he'd say, "I'll be right back." And he'd go get his Bible and he'd sit down across from those guys and say, "You boys ready?" You know. And it was just on, you know. So, I mean, I would sit there and watch all these things happen, you know. And by the time he's done with them, they're like, you know, this door-to-door thing kind of sucks. He has a point, you know. I mean, that was just the whole deal with him. So I learned everything I need to know about it. So imagine me coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and now you're the ones telling me again I got to have God? I'm like, no, man, that doesn't fly for me. Because, see, I've been in your meetings, and I saw you people. And y'all seem like good people. So he is probably going to work for you, but he doesn't work for people like me. So I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked into AA. I walked into an AA meeting. It was on a Thursday. And I hadn't showered since Sunday. And I worked construction, and I was filthy, and I was dirty. And I was an animal. And I sat in that meeting that night, and somebody jumped up and they said, this guy got up and he shared a story. And I walked out after that first guy shared a story, because he said things that night that I couldn't ignore. I couldn't deny. They said things that were going on inside of me in the moment. See, I'd been to see all those people with all the fancy initials after their names and all the well-meaning people in my life. And the problem with that is that, see, they just don't, they would talk to me. They wouldn't talk. They would talk to me about me. They wouldn't talk about themselves. And this guy is talking about himself, and he's talking about this illness called alcoholism. So I went out that night, did the only thing I knew how to do, and I grabbed that first drink, and I threw it back, and I grabbed the second one. And the problem is that when you have a mind that won't shut off, because by this time I'm drinking, my mind isn't even shutting off anymore. I'm drinking just to get the images out of my head. I'm drinking to stop the madness. I hadn't partied for a few years. That part's done. I'm drinking to survive in this moment. And I called in sick to work that night. And I knew if I went to the shop that Friday that there'd always be beer in the shop on Friday. And I knew if I went to the shop that Friday, I'd get drunk. So I called in sick to work that night and I detoxed over the weekend. You see, the problem is that I didn't get to go through a treatment facility or get to do any of that kind of stuff. I came in straight off the street to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I didn't have the medical come down. So I went through the hard stuff. I went through the shaking and I went through the delusions and where you think stuff's crawling out of your skin. And the whole entire time I'm screaming and praying that God just kill me because I can't feel like this anymore. And I'm begging to not wake up in the morning. And I'd wake up the next morning and have to relive the pain all over. And I just knew that's all I need to know about God. Because see, in this moment, he's supposed to have mercy. And if he had any mercy, he'd have took me. And he didn't take me. So I walked into the Alcoholics Anonymous the next week and I had a chance to shower and I walked into that meeting. The guy stuck his hand out and he said, welcome. And see, he came walking down the sidewalk at me and when he got close to me, he put his hand out and he didn't say anything smart mouth. He didn't say, oh, did you get jumpy feet last week? He didn't say anything like that to me at all. If he'd have said anything like that to me at all, you'd have a different speaker tonight. What he did is he stuck his hand out and he shook my hand and he took me up and he introduced me to some guys and they asked me to read how it works at the meeting that night. And afterwards, there was part of that. It was a beautiful thing about that group that I sobered up in is after I got sober, they walk up and after I read how it works, they walk up to me after the meeting and they said, man, when you read Third Step tonight, man, something clicked for me. I really appreciate how you read the Third Step tonight and how it works. And I had pumped me up a little bit and I got all excited, you know, and I'm like, yeah, that'll work, you know. And the other thing is they kept talking about sponsorship and do you have a sponsor? It's like that. I think in an hour long engagement with these fools, I think I heard the word sponsor 647 times, you know, I mean, it was ridiculous. I was walking into the bathroom and somebody was talking to me about a sponsor. And while I was in the bathroom, somebody was talking to me about a sponsor. And by the time I'm breaking the door, I've got two dudes there shaking my hand, asking me if I had a sponsor. They didn't even ask me if I washed my hands. They were just saying, hey, do you have a sponsor? I mean, it was an ambush, you know? And all I knew is I didn't know anything about a sponsor or anything else like that. But this guy that had shook my hand, he gave me his business card and his business card said Kraft Foods on it. And it was just a cool thing because I figured sponsors. Yeah, somebody kind of helps you out, gives you some money and gets you on your feet. And this guy says, Kraft, I mean, this got to be a good one, you know. Wrong. That was not the situation at all. They don't pay. If you're new and you're on the call tonight, AA does not pay for you to get on your feet. AA is not sponsored by blue chip businesses. That was also a lie, I believed in my head. You know, I was trying to find one that like Nestle Next or something. I wanted to move up the chain, you know, but that wasn't the case. But what I did is I walked into a group of people that believed in action and Alcoholics Anonymous, and they believed in the steps and they believed in this in recovery and they believed in giving somebody like me the one thing I desperately needed, which was love. And I didn't realize that what their love looked like. All I knew is that I didn't want to be the animal that I had been, and these people seemed to be nice to me. But the thing is that night, after this barrage of sponsor, I go to coffee with these guys afterwards, and I found out you have to go to coffee too. Apparently, it's written in the big book somewhere that you must go to the coffee after the meeting. If it's not, then those guys lied to me. At that moment, it seemed like that was a requirement in Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was like, everybody's going to coffee. You're going to coffee. And I'm like, fine, I'll go. They said it's the second half of the meeting. And I was like, what did we just do for the last hour? But I wasn't going to ask the question. And I got up there with those guys and I went to that guy that handed me his business card, and I started dropping all the hints. You know, I was, I heard you sponsor people. I said, do you sponsor people? Oh, yep, sure do. You know, and, oh, that's good. How do you get a sponsor? And he's like, oh, you have to just ask. And I mean, I have never been as uncomfortable asking a woman out in my lifetime as I was in that moment asking this dude to sponsor me. And so I just had to ask, and he made me ask. And I didn't realize that was my first moment of surrender in AA. I didn't realize that was, thank God he made me ask, because there was no going back on it after I asked myself. And the thing that he said, yeah, he goes, I'll agree to sponsor you, and I want you to do a few things. We're going to get my home group is now your home group. You know, we're going to go to this many meetings a week together, and all this other stuff. And then he did the AA catch-all. You know, I mean, if AA was a pyramid scheme, you know, like Amway or something, if it was one of those deals, this was the small print that they go over really fast so that you don't understand what you just signed, right? And what he said is, I'm going to ask you to take an active role in your recovery. And I said, okay. So I just signed a deal with the devil. And it was on. So, I mean, anytime I said I didn't want to do something in AA, he would use this small print hidden term of, you said you'd take an active role in your recovery on me. You know, we're going to go help Bob move. I just got done working 60 hours. I'm not going to burn up one of the only days I have off to help Bob. Bob lives on the third floor. You know, I'm pissed off, and I'm not going to go with these fools. And he's like, you said you'd take an active role in your recovery. You know, and I'm like, what are you going to weed me the third step while I'm moving Bob's couch? I mean, but no, I mean, that's what the situation was. And we would go and do anything. And they'd be like, hey, we're going to go share at this treatment center. I'm like, great. And we're getting in the car, and I'm watching the city lights behind me disappear. And I'm like, where is this place? Oh, it's in Jamestown. Jamestown is 2 hours, 2.5 hours away. And I'm like, this is a hostage situation now. You know, I mean, But you said you'd take an active role in your recovery. And so I started off in Alcoholics Anonymous with a boom. You know, I got in with these guys, and we would get together, and I was sober right around 3 weeks, and I show up, I'm at the meeting, and I had to get there early. And I don't know if you guys do this to people and trick them too, but you tell them they have to be there early to greet the newcomer. Well, if you're the newcomer, who the hell are you supposed to be greeting? You know, but they trick you because they tell you that's what you're supposed to do. So I was showing up at the meeting an hour before the meeting. Then I got to go to coffee for an hour and a half or whatever time they decide to go home after the meeting. So AA is like 4 hours a night, you know, and I'm like, this seems a little much, you know, but that's just what it was. And we're there, and I'm there before the meeting. And part of the format of that group, they said, anybody willing to be a sponsor, raise your hand. And I'm around 3 weeks sober. My sponsor elbows me. And so I throw my hand in the air. And this guy, Ben, comes up to me and asked me to sponsor him that night. And I said, the only thing I knew how to say to Ben is what I learned in AA, which was, are you going to coffee? So Ben said, yeah, he's going to coffee. And so we went up there, and I jumped in the car with my sponsor. And I'm like, this guy asked me to sponsor him. He said, yeah. He goes, tell him you'll do it. And he said, here we go. And so I would go and sit down with my sponsor, and I'd go through the big book. And as soon as I was done, I would go right out, and I'd sit down, and I'd go through the same stuff with Ben. And if Ben called me, I'd call him and run whatever Ben had ran by me by him. And so I've been involved in both sides of sponsorship since I was 3 weeks sober. And I was dropped in the middle of AA. And the problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is that they don't tell you early on to watch out for certain things. Now, and people say it, but you know, when I said they don't tell you, I mean, nobody sat me down specifically and broke it out step by step for me. But they didn't tell me that I would start becoming, that I would start on a quest to become a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't warn me that that was one of the side effects of AA, that if you have an ego like mine, that you're going to take off on a mission to become a big deal in AA. And the problem with being a big deal in AA, it's like being the kid on the short bus with the shiniest helmet, you know? I mean, you look pretty cool, but you're still on the short bus with the rest of them, man. I mean, it doesn't matter. You know, I mean, that's being a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous is not an achievable situation, apparently. But it did not stop me from trying to be one. And I took off on a mission in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you got within 15 feet of me, I was sponsoring you. If you had a service commitment, I didn't care if it was three states away, I would show up at your meeting to read how it works and drive home. You know, I mean, and what happened was, is I didn't realize I was building an AA resume. And when you're building an AA resume, you start keeping track of all the wonderful things you have going on in your life and all the achievements that you've got towards your goal of being a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if anybody says anything to you, you check your resume and you start figuring out that they don't do the things that you do, so they can't be right. And if you're going to be a big deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're going to be a guy who becomes a divisive idiot in the middle of AA, you have to learn the big book. And more importantly, you have to correct people when they say something wrong in the big book at the meeting. It doesn't matter who they are or what they say. So when people would say things, I was the guy that was sitting in there going through, you know why the comma is here? Because of the stop of this part of the thought of it, so that you don't transition the sentence together. There's a comma there. I've got to really make sure that they understand this text, because it saves our lives. And I use a book like a hammer and a sword instead of the thing to destroy people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I became the kind of person that I ended up hating. I hated myself in the middle of AA. And I'm walking around, and the problem is that just like any over, and I'm, this isn't a political thing and like that, it's history. I mean, people read whatever they want to read in whatever book to justify their actions. It doesn't matter if it's a war or if it's a jihad or what it is. People will use whatever term they want to use out of the book that they find that justifies their actions. So I found this part in Bill's story, and it said if we fail to perfect in a larger spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, we would not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. See, it didn't say through prayer and meditation. It said through work and self-sacrifice for others. Now, never mind all the other parts in the book where it tells us to pray, it tells us to meditate. I'm taking this one passage out of Bill's story, and I'm using it as my banner to ride into battle. And the problem is that when you're a guy that's doing that and you're sitting there and you're sober for a while in AA and you want to die every day, it's not a good place to be. And if you're ever around somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous and they'll say, you know, I'll never drink again. I'll put a bullet in the back of my head, but I'll never drink again. That guy needs help. That's not recovery. That guy needs probably the same thing I needed, which was God. And see, the problem is that I started using the same techniques I'd used when I was a kid. See, I'd go to the meetings and I'd do all the stuff in AA, and I'd hear somebody say something spiritual or something that sounded really good about God. And I'd make sure at the next meeting they weren't there, and I'd use their experience. But see, if you don't have a relationship with God of your own, you got to start stealing what other people sound like. So I spent a lot of time in AA professing to believe in something I didn't believe in, because I thought it would look bad. You can't be a spiritual guru in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about not having a relationship with God. But I spent a lot of time in AA in a lot of horrible places. Because see, I was still stuck on this idea that he's for good people and I'm not good people. So he'll work for you, he won't work for me. And I was crushed by my own personality in the middle of AA. And I had to, I got a different sponsor, and we started re-going through the steps in the book. And I started correcting a lot of that behavior and moving a little bit closer. And then I hooked up with the guy that I have now. This journey has been amazing. It has been something that is, unlike anything I've ever experienced before. See, the thing is that I have a fractured soul. I have a fractured sole, and if you know anything medically, you know that what happens with the fracture is that after the bone is reset and it's realigned, a calcification process happens within the bone and it starts to heal over. And when it heals over, it becomes stronger than the original bone was before the break, and that you'll never re-break the bone in the same place that it's been broken before. It may happen to the left, it may happen to the right, but not in the same spot, because now that spot has a higher tensile strength than the rest of the bone around it. See, I have a fractured sole, and nobody ever helped me set it. I never allowed anybody to help me set it. I'm walking around splintered the entire time. And I had to start doing some different things in AA. I got a friend of mine that said, you know, man, he goes, the difference between, you know, the big difference between me and God. And I go, what? He goes, nah. He said, God never gets up in the morning and pretends to be Calvin. That's the big difference, right? And the problem is that I spent all my time playing God. And the problem is I can't play God. I can't. For one, it tells me in the book that I'm not supposed to, right? But the reason why I can't is because I cannot be that loving. I cannot be that forgiving. I cannot be what he is. That's why I can't play him in my life. I'm incapable of that kind of love. See, I didn't know that God desperately wanted a relationship with me. I didn't know that. I didn't know that God doesn't have grandkids. That everybody is one of his kids. That there is no hierarchy when it comes to him. I didn't know those things. I didn't know that I would be able to be a free man today. I didn't know that there was anything that was capable of washing the blood off of my hands that I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. But apparently that there was. And that all I had to do was just open myself a little bit to let that in. And it started off on this weird little journey. If you've ever been driving by the same place, I drive the same route to work every day. And see, it's kind of those things that I was driving by, and all of a sudden on the corner of your eye, you see something. You're like, well, what was that? And you know you see something, but it's just a glimpse. Yeah, I just barely catch a glimpse of it. And I know I saw it, but I can't really tell what it was, but I knew it was there. And I keep driving by the same place again and again and again. And pretty soon I'm going a little bit slower. I'm not so hurried. And this time I get to see it, and I'm not going so fast, and I can make out what it is a little bit, and I can understand that it's there a little bit, and it's something there, and I can see it now. I can really see it. And eventually I just have to pull over. And when I pull over, I get to get out and I get to go look right at it, and I get to gaze upon what it is. I get to take a part of what that is and let that be a part of me, and I get to connect with it in that moment. So I got to go from a glimpse, a glance, into a gaze. And that's the thing that started happening for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, is I get to gaze upon this power that is greater than myself. And I get to let it be a part of who I am. And it was a really good thing that those things started happening for me, because in 2018, I was dropping a guy, a sponsor, off at the train station. And he's heading down to a treatment facility, and I'm dropping him off at the train station at 12:30 in the morning. And I get out and I give him a hug, and I'm walking back to get in my truck, and out of the corner of my eye, I see a flash of green, and a guy's coming out of nowhere with a knife, and he's trying to kill me. No idea who the dude was. They think he was probably just trying to get my truck. And because of the training that I had in the past, and because of the animal that I used to be, I was able to to parry his knife strike. He was trying to hit me in the back with. I saw him at the last second, get him on the ground and disarm him. And I've got his arm barred up and I've got my knee on his neck and I'm getting ready to do what I know how to do. And I'm getting ready to push down and twist and pull his arm back and I'm getting ready to kill him. I'm in the moment of getting ready to kill this man. And all of a sudden, something in the back of my head says, stop. I didn't have to be that animal anymore. God changed that in me. And I had to spend the next year going through court with this guy and going through all the stuff. And he was all messed up that night when he attacked me. And I got to sit on the other side of the aisle and understand what the victims of the people, the things that I did probably went through. That got to come full circle for me. And I sat there and I went through all the things that I got went through and at the sentencing at the hearing, I asked the state's attorney to allow me to say something. And the judge is getting ready to hand a sentence down. The guy did 60 days in a treatment facility and they weren't going to have him do any more jail time, but they had all these restraining orders and no contact and all this other stuff that he had to do. And I said, Your Honor, I'd like to have the restraining order and the no contact order removed. And the judge said, why? So that's, you've never been asked that before. And I said, sir, you know, I don't ever want to be the cause that this man can't go into a meeting if he needs to. And if he ever needs my help, I want him to be able to contact me and my numbers in the affidavits. He can find it. See, that's not who I am. That's what happens when God starts to change your heart a little bit. And I spent 2019 is so that happened. And then literally just 2 days later, I look at a message through a messaging board deal on Ancestry DNA. It's kind of a funny thing, right? So you grew up in North Dakota and, you know, my mom's white, my dad's black, and we got all this Ancestry DNA stuff because everybody can find out what they are. So when I said I'm part Irish, I really am. It's not a joke. I said that to some dudes from Ireland and they were like, nah, man, nah. And I'm like, no, really, I'm from South Ireland, you know, and they didn't think that was as funny as I did. You know, come to find out, I have all this Scandinavian heritage and everything and all this other stuff that goes on. And growing up, I found out all these percentages and I figured out that, you know, there's a reason why I've been way more cowboy than homeboy growing up in North Dakota. So that's kind of funny too. But because of Ancestry DNA, when I was 17 years old, I gave up a baby for adoption. It was a closed adoption. And by the time I was 17, I was an animal already. And this girl's parents knew who I was. And they knew who my family was. And they didn't want anything to do with any of that. And I couldn't tell my parents. Because, see, they would have fought like hell to keep that baby, and I didn't want that baby growing up in the same environment I grew up in. I didn't want that baby to grow up afraid. So I gave this baby up for adoption. And I get sober in AA, and I'm doing all this stuff, and this is on my list. You know, it's on my list of amends to make for giving up this baby, and I want to contact this girl, and I want to explain things. And I get told that, man, you can't do that. If her parents never told her she was adopted, you blow her entire life up. You know, you'd ruin everything. So I just had to let that one go and pray and say, God, if you got this, you got this. Well, literally 2 days after that court thing, when I sat there and told that judge those things, 2 days later, God got this. And I got a message through there and she's reaching out to me and says, I don't need anything. I just want to know who I am. And see, my wife and I have a daughter. And when she was 16 years old, she kind of blew up at us and got all mad and everything because she didn't have any siblings. And we couldn't tell her that this is a possibility. So we got to sit her down and explain to her, hey, you have a sibling now, you know, kind of a deal. And I get on the phone with this girl and I explain this. And the first question I asked her, I said, does your parents know that you're calling me? And she said, yeah, they know. They said to tell you that they love you and to thank you for giving me up so they could have me as a daughter. And so in October of last year, what happened between June of 2019 and October of last year was, can only be described as disgustingly cute. I mean, if like Lifetime and Hallmark had a baby and sent it to Positivity Bible Camp or something, that's what the situation would be. It's just gross. It's so cute. There's been this connection that's happened, and we went down there and she was getting married, and her and my other daughter connected so well that she asked her to be a bridesmaid, and we went down there and had dinner in her parents' house, and I got to shake the man's hand to raise her. I had to thank him for the things that he did, and I got to tell him my story, and I got to tell him why. And he took me outside that night and he sat me down. He said, man, he goes, you knew that if you kept that baby would go through hell and might have to grow up the way you did. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, man, so you were protecting her. He goes, that's what a father does. And he let me off the hook. He did something for me that nobody else could do. He gave me the permission to be a man that night and to realize that I had taken a fatherly action and didn't even know it. And it's been an amazing process. Got to go to the wedding and they asked me to do a reading at the wedding and it was magical. And see, that's what God can do. That's what God can change your heart. He can help you be something that you're not. He can take somebody that's an unlovely creature and make them lovable again. Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life, and it's given me more than I could ever pay back if I live 10 lifetimes. It gives me the ability to live here today and to look you people in the eye and know that you're all God's kids. If nobody told you today that they love you, I want to say that I love you. I want to thank you for the opportunity, ability to be able to share today, and that's all I have. God bless.